the past, the problem, at least in the recent years, was production. The price was high, but now we have a problem with both price and production.
State lawmakers send suggestions to the governor for reducing the deficit. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, December 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Sitka Assembly votes to help the community hospital.
If we don't pay this, the hospital cannot exist. They need the money. They're not going to be able to keep the doors open or make payroll if they don't get $1 million.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Fish Basket Coalition, working to secure a bright future for Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea, where fishing means business. Visit fishbasket.org to learn more.
And by
BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
Alaska lawmakers sent a letter to Governor Bill Walker this week urging measures to rein in budget items. Incoming Senate President Kevin Meyer, a Republican from Anchorage, and House Speaker Republican Mike Chenault of Nikiski signed the letter, along with the chairs of the finance committees for both chambers. The letter lays out suggestions such as a hiring freeze for all state departments, limiting agency travel, and requesting department budgets for the first 6 months of 2015. Senator Meyer says lawmakers only have 90 days to do their work, and they've not seen the governor's plans.
We've heard all sorts of different things during the campaign that he wants to add to education, wants to add to Medicaid expansion, but yet he wants to make 15-16% across the board reductions. And I don't know that those are accurate in today's environment. So we just want to see what he is thinking or what his expectations are. And again, it's more of a courtesy thing, just that the sooner we can get this information, the better.
Meyer says ideas like a hiring freeze may not be possible in all departments, such as public safety or corrections, but the desire is to get clarity from the Walker administration about what could be coming.
A statement to that effect or something similar to that, I think, would again help us sell the message out to the general public that, we have a major budget deficit that we're serious about addressing, and it's something that we want to incorporate everyone's thoughts and ideas on it, and especially the governor's.
Other ideas are to look at capital appropriations that are more than 5 years old to see if that money could be reappropriated to other more pressing needs. Meyer says the Office of Management and Budget figures show between $3 and $4 billion in capital projects that are encumbered but not yet spent. As others have acknowledged, Meyer says Alaska has seen large fluctuations in oil prices in the past, and as recently as the late 90s and early 2000s, there were deficits to be dealt with.
In the past, the problem, at least in the recent years, was production. The price was high, but now we have both a problem with both price and production.
He says lawmakers hope the gas pipeline project will stay on track so production can add to state revenue in a decade.
I think our gas looks good because I think it is going to replace coal in China and nuclear in Japan. But I think oil is always going to be around, and I think countries like the Middle East and Russia are going to make sure that they're around, and as economies rebound in Europe and in China, the demand's going to grow, and so I too would see that the price is going to go back up, but when is anybody's guess.
Governor Walker sent a letter today asking all commissioners to identify potential cuts to their departments by January 10th. A statement from Walker's office says in part that Walker shares the concern about a need for action and that he and his team have been in nearly daily budget meetings for several weeks. Sitka Community Hospital will get a $1 million infusion of cash from the Sitka Assembly in order to meet short-term expenses. A long-term solution for the hospital's cash woes is still on the horizon. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
There was no public opposition at all during the Assembly's last regular meeting of 2014 to increasing Sitka Community Hospital's line of credit. Assemblymember Matt Hunter said there really was only one choice.
If we don't pay this, the hospital cannot exist. they need the money. It's not going to, they're not going to be able to keep the doors open or make payroll if they don't get $1 million soon. And let's say for some reason we decided not to do it. We still have to pay $1 million, and we have no chance of raising additional revenues. We're going to drop services and jobs, and it's just not, this is a no-brainer to extend this.
During public testimony, the hospital's director of outpatient services, Kay Turner, and board chair Celeste Tydinko read a prepared statement describing the long decades of service provided by the hospital. "We've been there when you needed us," they said. "Now we need you." Marilyn Coruzzi is a physician. The crisis didn't add up for her.
And we're working 10, 12-hour days, and accounts receivable is this phenomenal number, and we're being encouraged to work twice as hard. And we really don't understand how we got where we are.
Physical therapist Bridget Hitchcock said she trusted new CEO Jeff Comer, who took the post in October.
"I feel like Jeff has the skills to help us figure out a new plan, whether that's collaboration with search or whether that's figuring out what we're going to do well, or, I mean, I don't know what it's going to look like. But I'm committed to this process, and I'm committed in supporting the leadership in this process, and that includes you guys."
Jeff Comer appeared via teleconference. He told the assembly that the $1 million would create breathing room to work toward a long-term solution, which he anticipated to be 6 to 9 months out. The city's chief administrative officer, Jay Sweeney, has been working mornings at the hospital to help assess finances there. His conclusion wasn't any brighter.
"By January the 10th, $960,000 of the $1 million will be expended, assuming no revenues came in the door, no collection."
But revenues are expected to come in. Municipal Administrator Mark Gorman said the hospital should have a plan in place within the next 4 weeks to control the damage and to prevent a repeat of this request in the near future. The assembly voted unanimously to support the $1 million loan. Before he signed off, Comer said, "It's going to be a rough couple of months for us." Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the incoming Commissioner of Natural Resources talks about the need to balance resource priorities.
And to do that, you have to have good data and good science. You have to understand the system. You also have to understand the needs of the people in the communities.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
A report from the State Fire Marshal's office has ruled the cause of a fire that burned the new Philip Ayugnovich Treatment Center, or PATC, in Bethel, as undetermined. The building is owned by the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation and was fully insured. The report, completed December 10th, according to state fire officials, was released to KYUK on the 24th. Dacia Eaton has the story.
The new 16-bed alcohol treatment facility was under construction and 90% framed. In the report, investigators say the fire started in the southwest corner of the building near a locked utility locker, but they couldn't determine the ignition source. They rule out all possible mechanical and electrical causes. The summary does not explicitly rule out arson. The case is closed now, but could reopen if further information is received. Dan Winkleman is the CEO for YKHC. His only comment was that YKHC offers a $5,000 reward for information that leads to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for the recent fire at PATC. Investigators asked local crews about vandalism and were told that there had not been any recent problems, but there were problems with spray painting several months ago. The report says four young people who just left the teen center were the first witnesses as they walked toward the power plant. Investigators interviewed the teens for their report and collected photos and video from their phones. One of the teens said they saw a light at the building but realized it was a fire once they got closer. One teen climbed a ladder and said he saw electric wires burning, sparking, and a shelf on fire. The first photo was taken at 8:15 p.m. The teens said they called 911 at 8:20 and started recording video at 8:26. The Bethel Fire Department was dispatched to the blaze at 8:19 p.m. on Monday, October 27th. The report says the building is a total loss. The estimated value of the structure and contents is more than $12,500,000. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Mark Myers is preparing to become Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources on January 16th. He is currently Vice Chancellor of Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Myers has also worked for the oil industry as a petroleum geologist and for the federal government, leading the United States Geological Survey. And he was director of the Division of Oil and Gas when Frank Murkowski was governor. Myers says he made a difficult decision to resign from that job.
We were negotiating a very large gas line deal with the major producers, and myself, as well as the Commissioner of Natural Resources and the Deputy Commissioner, felt that the deal we negotiated was beyond our authority under the law. And so at that point, Commissioner Irwin asked for a clarification from the Attorney General, and at the point he asked for that opinion. Again, we were very concerned that we weren't legally correct in where we were. And when Governor Murkowski let go of Commissioner Irwin, the rest of us decided we could no longer support the process. Again, we felt fundamentally we were outside our legal authority and what was being negotiated. So basically, part of my management style is that integrity. I have to believe that I'm doing the right thing for the people or of Alaska, or I simply can't do it.
How do you see your role in, we've had different commissioners in the past, some have been very resource-focused, development-focused, and others have not. How would you say that you want to look at balancing those duties?
Well, first of all, you look at the job description, you look at the state constitution, and when you look at those, it's for the benefit of the people, maximum benefit of the people of Alaska, which is a very broad statement, as you said, because there are a lot of different users of different resources. So when you look at it, you need to manage the resource base in a sustainable fashion. And given that most of our income is coming from non-renewable resources, first of all, it's important that the state collect what's appropriate in terms of value out of those resources, so that then those resources can be used, the income from those resources can be used to develop the economy, develop the infrastructure, public schools, public safety, all the things that we depend on. So it's important that the state get decent value out of its resources. At the same time, it needs to build an economy. So there's an economic component. There's a understanding that you have to develop those resources in the concept of the ecosystem. So we have to make sure we protect the other natural values along with those. And inherently, there's some conflict with that, just the nature of the changes that large-scale resource development causes. So balancing that is really important, understanding the long-term consequences and making good decisions with good public input. So again, it's a true balancing act of balancing the needs of the current generation of people, the needs for income, the needs for preservation, and the needs for long-term sustainable development of the non-renewable and renewable resources together. It's complicated, but it's important. And to do that, you have to have good data and good science. You have to understand the system. You also have to understand the needs of the people in the communities.
What do you think the biggest challenges ahead will be for your department?
Well, I think everyone, because we are so dependent on oil revenue, the current budget crisis is real. So we are going to have to make cuts in terms of our state government, in terms of services. It's just where we're at in the short term. At the same time, we have to recognize that commodity prices, as oil, are very cyclic, and they will come back up again. So within that structure, we have to make wise decisions on what we choose to cut and what we choose to keep. And we have to make sure that we don't kill the golden goose at the same time. So it's a real balancing act. The biggest challenge will be not to knee-jerk and make short-term decisions that have really negative long-term repercussions. The second is we clearly need to broaden the base in our oil industry. We have a relatively small number of companies exploring developing Alaska. And if we want to have more capital, we have to bring more companies in on the oil and gas front in terms of seeing these smaller companies that are often the innovators come and invest more in Alaska to look at our remaining oil and gas resources, conventional and the non-conventional resources, which have not yet been developed in Alaska. So that's in one part of it, is building the economic base. At the same time, you know, I've because of the changing climate, because of our environmental changes, we're going to manage our resource base adaptively. So working with stakeholders to make sure that we make really wise resource decisions. And we revisit resource decisions when we see the baseline conditions have changed. So that's really important, important piece of an adaptive management structure for a very structured decision-making for these complex resource decisions. So I'd like to do what I can to make sure that in the departments is fully engaged with using the best available science in this decision-making.
The state is currently in talks with the North Slope producers to develop a natural gas pipeline. How has the transition from Parnell to Walker affected these conversations?
Since I'm not officially even in the job, I've had some briefings on non-confidential briefings on where we are. But I think right now the Walker administration's learning what's been negotiated and what hasn't been negotiated. It intends to continue those discussions and negotiations. But we're really in that learning phase of learning what's been done. We're looking at the technical teams and the data from the technical teams that so far is available. So we're sort of in that deep dive stage to actually figure out where we are in that structure. Clearly, the administration wants to see a large gas line, so it's working toward that end. So I would say right now, stay tuned. We're really just in that process of evaluating where we are.
And although you haven't had a confidential briefing, as you mentioned, you're not in the job yet, do you have, this is a field, an area that you know a tremendous amount about, have worked in for many years, do you have specific ideas for what needs to be done to proceed with plans for a gas line?
Well, certainly, the largest challenge is this is a very, very expensive project, no matter how you build it. If you make it to scale enough, so you're pushing large enough volumes of gas to make it commercially viable. So with those large capital costs and with the state's planned involvement in that project, the state has to really look at its risk profile. Where is it going to come up with the capital for its share of its investment? What's the risks to the state? And then furthermore, what does the market really look like? We have to understand the gas market out there, 10 years from now, 8 to 10 years from now. And there's a lot of uncertainty in that market right now. So locking in those key variables is the first thing. Really understanding is the market prices, are they going to be high enough to support the project? Can you get willing buyers? Can the state manage its share of risk with the price volatility, potential cost overruns in the project? And how the state chooses to do that is really important.
Mark Myers is the incoming commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. He starts January 16th. A longer version of this interview is at our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is an archived edition of AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, exploding history. It's been more than 70 years since Unalaska came under attack during World War II, but you don't have to look hard to find the remnants. The community is littered with old gunnery installations, battered Quonset huts, and bunkers, some of which are being preserved for posterity. But there's history and there's hazard. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, the shells and bombs that keep washing up on Unalaska's shores fall somewhere in between.
Out on a quiet beach at the edge of the island, Unalaska Shooting Range is where local gun owners go for target practice. But the team of Army and Air Force munitions experts that have converged on the range aren't here to practice anything. They've flown in just to examine a mysterious shell that may date back to World War II.
Go ahead and take a couple minutes and try to get a quick ID.
That's Air Force Sergeant Luke Mefford. He's the head of the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. The EOD team has come out to Unalaska, Adak, and other Aleutian communities over the years to identify and safely destroy leftover munitions from the war. Usually these items get picked up by beachcombers or fishermen. Even though they've been swimming in salt water for decades, that doesn't mean they're inert. Army Sergeant Joe Pataki explains.
Some old explosives use like nitroglycerin, which is highly sensitive. And being so old, it's not in a state that it's supposed to be in. You mess around with it, it can definitely go off. That's why we're around. That's why we got a job.
The job that brought them to Unalaska this time was an effort at historical preservation gone wrong. The Unalashka Corporation runs the World War II Museum. Their manager, Dave Gregory, says he was out at lunch one day when an employee of a local fish plant dropped off a donation.
It was about, 20 inches long, 6 inches at the base, and then it kind of tapered down, kind of a greenish, dirty color, I guess.
Gregory is no stranger to ordnance. He says the museum does like to collect small pieces to put in its displays. They add some color. This shell was different, though. It was heavier and bigger than anything Gregory had seen, and it didn't seem like a good thing to keep around. So he called his friends at Public Safety. They took custody of the shell and contacted the EOD team for disposal. In Unalaska, the team is coping with miserable weather. They take turns snapping photos on the windy, snowy beach. One by one, they dart into a running fire truck for warmth while they consult munitions manuals. Finally, Sergeant Mefford walks up. They have an ID.
It's an artillery round, more than likely fired from a naval ship out in the water somewhere, either for target practice or depending on the exact time period, may have been used against enemy actions.
Mefford says he can't share any more information than that because the rest is classified.
Can't really give you specifics on it, just due to our disclosure rules on it.
The team wastes no time setting up the blast site.
We're going to have enough antenna to get up on top of this, Scotty?
Yeah, we should. Those caps.
They pack the shell in a hole and cover it with about 6 pounds of C4, a plastic explosive. They poke in some blasting caps, which are tuned into a remote control. Once it's set up, we're directed to take cover several hundred yards away behind two gravel berms. We're waiting for the remote control to warm up when the team asks me if I want to be the one to set off the explosives.
Can I?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I can do it?
Yeah.
We'll
be ready to go in about 30
yeah,
seconds.
We're not doing it yet. He's going to set his camera up when we give him the go-ahead.
While we wait for Fire Chief Abner Hoag to set up his video camera, I get some basic instructions.
So when we get ready to fire this thing, under this cover is one fire button. So you just press and hold one of them, and then press and hold the other. And it'll be about a 2 second delay, and then the shot will go off.
Wow.
Oh yeah, and before you set that off, you have to yell fire in the hole three times as loud as you can.
Okay.
Once forward, once off to your left, once off to your right.
Okay.
Air Force Sergeant Scott Rice and I trade. He takes my microphone and recorder, and I take his remote detonator. Without further ado, fire in the hole! Fire in the hole! Fire in the hole!
Hold it up nice and high.
Oh, whoa! That is a giant plume of smoke. Wow, that's a rush.
Bits of shrapnel rain through the air, some of them even flying past the berms carried by the high winds. Once the dust settles, the team tells me that they like to let visitors detonate the explosives when they're working in the field.
Thanks for letting me do that. It was really fun.
All right, we're good to go. We can go down and check it out.
All that's left of the shell is a 4-foot round hole. They measure it and pack up their equipment pretty fast.
Yeah, I know the aftermath isn't as exciting. There's a hole in the ground.
The team heads back to the Unalaska firehouse for a quick debrief. I ask if any of them thought about the history of the shell before they blew it up, and they say they did.
And it's just neat to come across something that, you know, your granddad or great uncle, whatever, might have shot 70 years ago, and hey, you know, it's laying on the beach now, so.
Probably looked a lot better, though.
Yeah, it probably looked a lot shinier back then.
The EOD team is pretty sure that ordnance will keep washing up in Unalaska for a while. That's why when it's time for them to fly back to their base in Anchorage, saying see you later seems a lot more appropriate than saying goodbye. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're headed to Tuliksak, a community of almost 400 people near the Kuskokwim River.
I'm George Lamont, and I live in Tuliksak. We're about 30 miles away from the Tilbuk Mountains. We live in a pretty vegetated area. quite flat. We're about roughly a mile and a half away from the Kuskokwim River up a river called the Tolksack River. Right now, there's possibility of another flood since 2009, I think. The conditions are quite bad right now since the snow's been melting. We have a lot of puddles and we have no road maintenance or anything like that. We have no water and sewer. We still live off what they call a honey bucket. And we still have to pack our own water. Our electricity is around 65 cents per kilowatt hour. And our fuel prices, well, last time I heard it was $10 a gallon. And then it went down to $9.50 a gallon. It's pretty hard living out here in this remote village here. For fun, those people mostly play bingo, and most of the time there's what they call fiddling. And what fiddling is they have a band in the meeting, the group meeting. Most of the people from the village go to that fiddling, and plus there's some basketball games.
George Lamont is resident of Tuliksack. His interview is from May 2013. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to this archived edition of AK. We had help from Lauren Rosenthal and Annie Feit. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey in Sitka and Daisha Eaton in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.